Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Warsaw over the last weekend saw the biggest demonstration rally since 1989. The opposition gathered somewhat 1 million people on the street of Warsaw who marched in support of the opposition taking over the government in elections that are going to be held on the 15th of October. My name is Wojciech Przybylski. Together with me, there is Adam Jasser. And we're recording this podcast on Monday, 2nd of October, 2023, to speak about Warsaw elections and the elections in Slovakia that also took place last weekend. Adam, what are your takeaways from this very eventful Saturday and Sunday?
Both events were very important, but obviously the result of the Slovak election is probably the top item. It produced some surprises, but in the end it confirmed something we have seen for a while, namely that ex-Prime Minister Robert Fico, is a front runner to win the vote. He did. He secured 42 seats in a 150-seat lower house, which forces him into, if he wants to be prime minister, he needs to forge a coalition with another leftist party, Hlas, which came third, and probably with one more small party, and the most likely candidate for that is a small nationalist outfit, which got 10 seats in parliament. The surprise is that some of the far-right parties that only a few months ago were polling at around 12-13%, failed to pass the 5% threshold. I'm speaking of the Republika Party. So if you actually look at the result, Fico's victory is not as strong as he would have hoped, probably. And parties which overall you could call moderate still gathered a lot of support, including the three smaller parties that back the current outgoing government. Together they got 20% of the vote. So the bottom line is a fragmented parliament, a weak majority if he manages to cobble it together for Fico. And the question is to what extent this leaves him space to alter course on particularly Ukraine. Because before the election, this is what Fico was campaigning on, stopping support for Ukraine, sounding more pro-Russian sometimes even than Viktor Orban. So the question is, was it just posturing, or is he going to really try to push through a change of course for Slovakia?
Now, I would warn against complacency here in terms of who Fico is today as an ex-prime minister and indeed a person who has built himself not just on mildly pro-Russian sentiments that are indeed quite prevalent in the Slovak society, but someone who campaigned from the very beginning and in the beginning of the year appeared on the Hungarian main news channel operated by the government, Viktor Orban, to speak in the evening news the most pro-Russian messages you can imagine, directed at exactly Hungarian minority in Slovakia. The interview was in Hungarian. Mr. Fico has been before very outspoken against Hungarians. They've been often having political sparrings with Mr. Orban in the past 20 years. I mean, in the past 10 years, there have been often quite undiplomatic, let's say. But this way, they were just like football hooligans, able to mobilize their crowds of supporters and polarize the debate, polarize the tensions also that are over the two countries. It's important, particularly in Slovakia, where 10% of the population of Slovakia is Hungarian. In the south and the regions of Slovakia, we have about 500,000 of people, Hungarians, and none of the Hungarian minority parties actually made it this time to the parliament. So the voice of Viktor Orban is the voice that prevails from these elections in Slovakia in this particular group. And also because Mr. Fico has been heavily sponsored by Mr. Orban, and Orban also famously now tweeted a welcome back message showing old photo shaking hands with Prime Minister Fico from before, is basically saying that the messages that have sedimented in Budapest and that splintered also the Warsaw-Budapest axis in security dimension at least, are now going to be much more vocal in Slovakia. Mr. Fico is now pro-Russian, campaigning against arms delivery to Ukraine and against NATO Ukraine joining NATO, and all of that, indeed, without the most radical fascist party, Republika. By the way, we're published by Respublika Foundation in Poland, and it turns out that we might be one of the only, if not the only, Respublika institutions in the region that does not actually represent right or far right, but rather liberal ideas with some Republican left and right corrections. But that's on the sideline. The message is that Mr. Fico now is forming this weakling coalition with potentially with SNS party, Slovak Nationalist Party, which is also led by a pro-Russian politician, Mr. Danko, who has been frequent visitor for many years, whenever he had opportunity to Moscow in 2018-19, he's been famously basically demonstrating with his visit that he supports Russian position on Crimea and in Ukraine. And he's been also vocal about Crimea belonging to Russia. So in all, Ukrainians and allies have a problem because Slovakia is one of four countries bordering with Ukraine, is now the second one not to be trusted on sharing intelligence and passing any military equipment or munition to Ukraine because of the fears that Russia will simply get that message before Ukrainians know about it. So this is the seriousness of the situation. Slovakia might be tempered in their voting in the EU, and eventually also it's a Eurozone country, so much more stable in terms of resilience to radical populism, especially fueled by production of the domestic currency. They have limitations, therefore, because they need to play a bigger game, as Slovakia is also suffering from economic downturns, and it needs to be a well-behaving country in order to make life better and prosperity better for its citizens and voters. But the messages on security are indeed quite worrying. Adam, maybe we move now to the march. We've been hearing a lot, and I think there's a lot of interest both among our listeners and in general in the media. The headlines all over the world speak of again the big march of the opposition, while the party retreated to Silesia region, Katowice, and tried to mobilize their core electorate, or at least core party activists who joined them at a conference. So they were totally absent from Warsaw, and the streets in Warsaw were dominated by the supporters of the opposition. Do you think this is important 2 weeks ahead of the vote?
Well, you know, given that opinion polls suggest it's a very close race between law and justice and the opposition, every percentage point matters. So, you know, certainly the civic coalition managed to demonstrate its ability to rally people. The tone of that meeting was also in stark contrast to Law and Justice, because it was open, it was peaceful, it was colorful, it was sort of, it was trying to present a choice of Poland, which is part of Europe, which is moderate, smiling, confident, whereas law and justice seems to be struggling to find narratives other than fear-mongering, attacks on Germany, now attacks on Ukraine as well. So basically a picture of a country under siege from everybody. So it's a clear contrast of two visions of Poland. And the question is, you know, surveys indicate that there's still a relatively big pool of undecided voters. So what it boils down to is whether Civic Coalition and Mr. Tusk, the former Prime Minister of Poland and former head of the European Council, whether that vision of open Poland in the European mainstream, liberal, is going to attract more of these undecided voters than Mr. Kaczyński's vision of Poland, which is surrounded by enemies, and Poland which needs stronger government to sort of resist these external pressures.
Yeah, indeed. And a fun fact from the conference in Katowice by PIS is that Mr. Morawiecki has quoted Civic Platform and Mr. Tusk 44 times in his short speech, his statements at the podium, which was recorded and uncounted by people who are following his speeches closely. And then you can find very funny videos basically showing a certain, not just obsession, but creating a tube for the Civic Platform and Tusk, because it seems that in this country, no one speaks about anything else that Mr. Tusk and Civic Platform, including the government. So now we're looking into this very intense 2 weeks of the campaign, last 2 weeks, with, I'm sure, a lot more coming up. You can read about our projections, our dynamics. In the past couple of weeks, we've been publishing a lot also on the state of the relationship between Poland and Ukraine, which is also suffering a lot. And our prediction with Adam is that should the right wing actually win, the nationalist messages that are anti-Ukrainian also will sediment in Poland, creating much more turmoil for the situation in the front, in the battle against the Russian autocracy that wants to capture Europe. Now, to understand that better, we invite you cordially to our set of events for subscribers only. Next week, we're hosting 4 events with 12 fantastic speakers, opinion leaders, experts, analysts, who will explain Poland, state of Poland, in 4 subsequent events held on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, state of Poland. Check on our website. Do register. It's for subscribers only. And we'll speak on Polish politics, the tense Ukraine and Polish relations, and also on the state of Poland economy and the state of Poland defense. We are inviting people who have been serving under PIS government, ambassadors to Ukraine. We are inviting people who've been vocal opponents of the current government, but also those who try to explain it better. From the British University perspective as well. So check out the event State of Poland and do subscribe if you want to attend. We are inviting you from the 10th of October, 9th of October, in fact. The first event is held on Monday, and they are held every day at 3 p.m. Central European time, which is 9 a.m. Eastern time. In the US, making it more approachable and then basically for our colleagues and subscribers across the Atlantic to join. So I think that's it. Thanks a lot for listening. And now let's turn to the interview with our guest.
Today, our guest is Richard Giragosian, the director of the Regional Studies Center, an independent think tank in Yerevan. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This was a dramatic week for Nagorno-Karabakh, the end of its autonomy, which is going back a century, and the exodus of more than half of the Armenian population there from their ancestral lands to Armenia proper. So first, I wanted to ask you, what is the immediate aftermath of Azerbaijan's takeover of Nagorno-Karabakh?
Well, unfortunately, the immediate aftermath consists of a successful military move by Azerbaijan to reconquer control of Nagorno-Karabakh, and most distressingly, to drive out the population, the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh. This is a dramatic change, not just in terms of geopolitics, but also geography. And with an influx of 99% of the Armenians from Nagorno-Karabakh into Armenia, it drastically changes the outlook for peace and for stability.
In what way?
Well, first of all, there are two especially dangerous precedents from these recent developments. First, Azerbaijan's military victory, its conquering of Nagorno-Karabakh, presents a distressing and dangerous precedent where the use of force is vindicated and validated over diplomacy. A second related precedent is actually a threat to Western values, and that is this military victory was very much a success for authoritarian power over struggling democracy. If left unchallenged, both precedents tend to undermine belief and confidence in democracy and in the Western value system.
All over the region or just in Armenia?
I would say all over the region, because the larger lesson learned from Azerbaijan's military victory is a lesson with broader implications. In fact, this is dangerous in terms of showing a lack of resolve of the West. Beyond Ukraine, if we see coming challenges to other vulnerable, struggling democracies like Moldova, for example, this raises concern that military might will go unpunished yet again. And this, in fact, is the broader danger and threat.
Right. Well, our initial interpretation was that, this would have been impossible without Russia actually switching sides to preserve its influence. So in effect, Russia teamed up with Azerbaijan and Turkey to subjugate Armenia and to push the West out.
Generally, yes, but it is a little more nuanced in one specific context, and that is Russia being overwhelmed and distracted by its failed invasion of Ukraine has actually surrendered its power and position in the region. In other words, yes, Russia is very much complicit with Turkey and Azerbaijan, yet Russia has been obviously humiliated by Azerbaijan, the Russian peacekeepers failing to uphold the Russian-imposed ceasefire. In other words, Azerbaijan has called the bluff of the Kremlin. So this is an interesting context beyond Russian complicity and allowing Azerbaijan to attack, but it's also a time of Russian weakness and insecurity, not confidence or power.
I understand, but at the same time, they still have like 12,000 troops in Armenia proper. And we've seen in recent days that they're also trying to undermine the legitimacy of the Armenian government.
No, I'm pleased to disagree to make a more interesting conversation. First of all, we have 2,000 Russian peacekeepers, isolated and largely forgotten by Moscow, that are still stationed in remote Nagorno-Karabakh. We have 7,000 total personnel at a Russian military base. That's a Cold War legacy and fairly insignificant militarily. The Russian military presence in Armenia has never been involved in defending against Azerbaijan's attacks. So I don't think Russia is as aggressive or is targeting Armenia as it seems, largely because it's overwhelmed by its failures on the battlefield against Ukrainian defenders. My second point would be as well, what we see here geopolitically is a shift more of Azerbaijan being self-confident, emboldened by a gas deal with the European Union, and under the perception of blind support from Turkey. And the danger going forward is what happens the day after. Azerbaijan is a danger and a risk that it may keep going because there's really no deterrence. And finally, Azerbaijan's recent military victory is actually just a continuation of the war of 2020. At that time, they didn't win enough. So this could be the final battle in the war 3 years ago.
Right. But to play the devil's advocate, you could argue that Nagorno-Karabakh was not internationally recognized. And that even the Western countries acknowledge Azerbaijan's right to hold the territory.
Armenia also did not and never has recognized the independence of Nagorno-Karabakh. But Western policy, and myself as a former U.S. government official, Western policy has long been that the status of Nagorno-Karabakh is subject to negotiations. Territorial integrity of Azerbaijan was always recognized, by Armenia included, but the status of Nagorno-Karabakh was an open question. That's the purpose of mediation, and the real reason is the reality. Nagorno-Karabakh seceded from Soviet Azerbaijan. This happened during the Gorbachev period. It was never part of independent Azerbaijan. So it's actually much more complex and therefore even more daunting.
Right. So the EU and the US were seeking to find a negotiated end and to find some kind of a compromise where the autonomy would be preserved while Azerbaijan's territorial integrity, as you said, would be confirmed. And obviously, they have been outmaneuvered by Azerbaijan, Erdogan, and ultimately Putin. So the question is, what should the Europeans and the Americans do in this situation?
Well, the problem is now it's too little too late. For one stark symbolic example, the United Nations, for the first time in over three decades, has finally engaged Nagorno-Karabakh. But by the time the UN has engaged, there's no more Armenians left in Nagorno-Karabakh for them to actually help or assist. So for the West, the damage has been done. And after the now humanitarian catastrophe, it is seen as too little too late. The next red line, however, is the Armenian border, because Azerbaijan's conquering of Nagorno-Karabakh is not as stark and not as a threat to international order as Azerbaijan's threat to Armenia. That would be a serious escalation involving an attack by one country against another, interstate. And that's what we're worried about now on the ground in Armenia.
So basically, are you referring here to this idea of building a corridor across Armenian territory to this Azerbaijani enclave there and ultimately to Turkey?
Yes and no. That's one part of it. That's a bit of Azerbaijan's bluff and bluster for its domestic audience. What I'm referring to is the attacks by Azerbaijan on southern Armenia last year. And we still, to this day, have Azerbaijani military personnel encamped and entrenched within Armenia's borders on Armenian territory. What this means is we need border demarcation. And there is still a draft peace treaty between Armenia and Azerbaijan that's under negotiations. My worry, however, is that Azerbaijan needs to keep going because of the domestic situation in Azerbaijan, a father-to-son dynasty that has ruled the country for a quarter of a century. The war, the conflict, has been a convenient distraction for the lack of democracy, family corruption. And I'm worried that it's the domestic agenda that's driving Azerbaijan ever further.
Right. And do you see Turkey playing a role in egging the Aliyevs in this endeavor?
I think Turkey's in a delicate but also dangerous position. Turkey long ago has lost the upper hand. It is Azerbaijan that determines the limits of Turkish policy options in this region. And I do think many in Turkey are worried that the overaction, overambition of Azerbaijan may prompt a conflict on the ground, where Turkey's dragged into a conflict with Russia on the ground. And that's more of a concern in Turkey. But I think there's immense frustration that's been accumulating that the little brother of the relationship, Azerbaijan, has such a dominant hold over Turkey.
Right. So that complicates things even further. And as if it wasn't complicated enough, we also have Iran that apparently is watching the situation there and also exerting some influence. Can you explain the rationale for that to us?
Well, from an Iranian perspective, there is a degree of logic. Armenia is the only friendly, stable neighbor of Iran, especially in contrast to its neighbors on the east and west, Iraq and Afghanistan. So in this context, the Iranian border with Armenia is very valuable. And Iran's national interest is to see no change to that geography and the geopolitical implications. Having said that, it's interesting that Iran is not really very active as a player. The traditional historic role in this region is a competition between three rival empires, the Persian, the Russian, and the Ottoman. In this context, it's really a contest involving Russia and Turkey. Iran hasn't been very active lately.
Obviously, due to the context of Western sanctions being isolated and so on and so forth, right?
Yes, of course.
Right. So, you know, given all the contradictions and this rivalry, which goes back centuries, as you rightly pointed out, what is the most sensible policy the West, namely the US and the EU, can apply now, not to make matters worse?
Well, it's simple. In terms of reaching the line of last resort, the red line of protecting Armenia from any possible attack by Azerbaijan, and allowing the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis to continue diplomatic negotiations over a peace treaty to normalize the neighborhood. No country chooses their neighbors. In the case of Armenia, it's been especially critical throughout history. However, I am optimistic. I'm optimistic that even after the military defeats this past 2 weeks, as well as back in 2020, Armenia has a long-term advantage. Armenia is endowed with a rare commodity of democratic legitimacy in an otherwise authoritarian region. Armenia has had two free and fair back-to-back elections. The government was even reelected after losing the war. There is greater stability and resiliency in Armenia, driven by the democratic credentials and legitimacy. And I do believe Armenia is nothing but a nation of survivors and has already overcome the more serious existential threats.
That's clear. But again, let me try to push you a little bit on what specific steps should the EU and the Americans take now?
Well, first of all, it's a process that has started. The EU has deployed monitors to southern Armenia, making the European Union a stakeholder in the security of the Republic of Armenia, something they couldn't do regarding Nagorno-Karabakh. The second policy is now being discussed in both Brussels and Washington, and that is the threat of sanctions. In other words, imposing a cost to any future Azerbaijani aggression, especially against Armenia, where the threat of sanctions is an attempt by the West to craft or restore deterrence in a situation where there is nothing and no one stopping Azerbaijan the imperative is deterrence, and it's the threat of sanctions that's the most practical way forward.
Should the EU-Azerbaijan energy agreement be off the table, suspended?
Well, yes, but for another reason. In other words, my frustration with the EU gas agreement with Azerbaijan is a little different. First of all, Azerbaijan and that gas agreement accounts for a little under 8% of European gas needs. It's rather marginal. But what's most distressing to me is the gas deal is actually a swap agreement where Azerbaijan re-exports Russian gas to the European Union and then is allowed to get away with it. For every shipment of gas from Azerbaijan, Russian gas is imported into Azerbaijan to replace the volume. It's a swap agreement. In cases involving Iran, the West has applied sanctions in those same swap agreements.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Richard, for this really in-depth assessment. So what's your bottom line? What should happen next?
Well, it's clear. We need a return to diplomacy and a renunciation of the use of force from this period forward. Full stop.
Okay. Is that forthcoming in your view?
Well, we've had some progress in diplomacy, the restoration of trade and transport, but that's very much a question only for Azerbaijan. Armenia's position is based on a painful yet realistic sense of weakness and a lack of friends, to be quite honest.
Right. Is there any threat to the government that there could be a change of government, a government that would suddenly find itself more accommodating to Russia and falling into the, as you described it, authoritarian camp?
The short answer is no. The longer answer is it's because there is no credible alternative to the current Armenian government. The opposition represents the past and is largely discredited. The second reason, however, is real anger and frustration in Armenia is blaming Russia. It is actually Russia that has betrayed Armenia. And in many ways, Russia poses a new, much more serious challenge to Armenia, that of an unreliable so-called partner. So I do think much of the anger will target Russia and Russia's role in allowing this to happen.
Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Adam.